Morning, if you'd like to be turning to 2 Kings chapter 4 this morning. 2 Kings chapter 4 is the text we're going to be looking at. Actually, 2 Kings chapter 3 is where we're going to start, 3 and 4 this morning. I went down to Florida and Jeff went down to Florida and only one of us came back. So it's hard to survive those harsh Florida winters. But now Jeff is out sick this morning, unfortunately. So I'm filling in for him. Hopefully he'll get well and be back with us pretty soon. But I want to say also to those who are visiting with us, we appreciate your presence here. Appreciate you being with us. We want to get to know you. If you have some time afterwards, stick around. Let us talk to you about what we do, what we believe. Let us have conversation with you and get to know you and think about those things. If there's anything we say in the sermon this morning or anything that we've done, feel free to ask us and talk to us about it. We'd love to discuss those things with you. There comes a point at which God accepts people's rejection of Him. And that's something we might understand in relationships with one another. That at some point, if I'm going to try to develop a relationship with you and you make it clear by some means or another that you don't want anything to do with me, at some point I have to accept that. Well, God does that as well. God reaches out His hand to all people. Yet at some point, after He gets rejected over and over and it becomes clear that you don't want a relationship with Him, He says, that's fine. You don't have to have that relationship with me. Some people just prove to God that their heart is not going to change, and God allows for that to happen. And when Ahab was king over Israel, there was a prophet named Elijah, one of the greatest prophets of the Old Testament. A prophet named Elijah that God sent in order to try to get the people to come back to Him. And if you remember your Israelite history, the Israelite kingdom, the northern kingdom, after they split, they were never faithful. There was not one good king that came from Israel. And so Ahab is in the line of these kings of Israel. And he is not only just like them, he is actually worse than them. Beginning with Jeroboam, they started turning to these false images, these golden calves, and one king after another constantly leaves the golden calves up. No one takes them down, but Ahab goes even farther. Not only does he leave the golden calves up, but at the instigation of his wife Jezebel, who is a foreign woman, a Canaanite woman, he brings in Baal worship. And so there is not just this false image of God, but really another God that is to be worshipped in Israel. And so in 1 Kings chapter 16, and we won't turn there and read that this morning, but in 1 Kings chapter 16, it talks about the extent of Ahab's sin, as how he took Jezebel to be his wife and turned the Israel to Baal. And what's interesting is that as this new God, or not really a new God, but new to Israelite worship, as he is being worshipped, as he is being introduced and worshipped by all the Israelites, God sends this prophet whose name is Elijah. And Elijah's name actually says a lot about what he's going to do as a prophet. His name means Jehovah is God, or God is Jehovah. That's what is in his name, and that is really a summary of his ministry as well. And if you look in your Bibles, a lot of times you'll see the word Lord in all caps. And that's really the name for God, the name we say Jehovah or Yahweh. That's God's name. And so a lot of times in the book of Kings or in the history of the Old Testament, in a lot of places, it is the declaration that Jehovah is God. They wouldn't say God is God. They might think that there are many gods, and Jehovah is just one of those gods. But as Elijah's name implies, no, Jehovah is God. Not only is he God, not a God, he is the God. And so there is no Baal worship. There is no Baal at all. And so we see Elijah, as his name implies, coming to tell them this message. Jehovah is God and no one else. And so you remember the story. Elijah and the prophets have this contest on Mount Carmel. All these 400 prophets of Baal who are encouraging this worship at the instigation of Jezebel and Ahab, they get together and Elijah says, let's see who the real God is. Let's see if it's God, if it's Jehovah, or if it's Baal. And what we'll do is we'll have a sacrifice. You have your sacrifice, your altar, your offering over there, and you call to God. And I'll do the same thing with my altar over here. I'll have a sacrifice. We'll both call on our gods. You call on Baal. I'll call on Jehovah. And whoever answers, that's the God. And so the prophets of Baal, you remember the story, they are calling out to Baal, crying to him. And Elijah starts mocking him and making fun of him. Well, maybe he went on vacation. Maybe he's off somewhere doing something else and he's too busy and he can't hear you right now. And they do all sorts of things to try to get Baal to hear them. They start cutting themselves and weeping and crying and all these different things all day long. Nothing happens. So Elijah takes this altar that he set up, takes a bunch of pitchers of water, douses it, digs a trench around the altar, fills that trench with water. It's just soaking, dripping, wet. And he calls on God, and immediately Jehovah, the true God, brings down fire, and the altar is consumed, and the water is consumed, and there is no question that Jehovah is God at the end of that story. And so they take down all those prophets, the 400 prophets, and they slaughter them in the valley, and this great victory happens for Jehovah on that day. But of course, you remember the aftermath of that story as well. What seems like this great victory, what seems like this declaration in no uncertain terms, in the most obvious ways that Jehovah is God, yet still, the people continue to worship Baal. Jezebel is not happy about this. Jezebel doesn't think to change her ways. She thinks, I'm going to kill this guy Elijah. I'm going to kill the guy who killed these prophets, who showed me up, who embarrassed me and my prophets. And so Elijah flees. He goes away. And Elijah is distraught there. He's on Mount Sinai and talking with God, and he feels like he's the only one there, and God reminds him, no, there's 7,000 other people. You're not the only one, Elijah. But really, not long after this contest on Mount Carmel, God sends another prophet to follow in the footsteps of Elijah. And his name, I should keep up with our PowerPoint here, his name is Elisha. And just like Elijah, his name means something to his ministry as well. Because you see, God has been declared, Jehovah has been declared God, and now he's been rejected. And so God, from this point on, we see a different dealing with the people of Israel. If you're going to reject me when I so clearly state that I am God, when I make it so obvious, and yet you're still going to turn to your false idols and false gods, then there's nothing I can do for you. You've proven to me that you don't want a relationship with me. And so God starts changing the way he's dealing with the nation as a whole. He's not concerned with bringing Israel back anymore. He's concerned with the people, though, the 7,000. He's concerned with those people who have not bowed the knee to Baal, who have seen that Jehovah is God and declare that in their lives and in their worship. And so he sends this prophet named Elisha. And Elisha, his name means God saves, and that's exactly what we see Elisha doing throughout his ministry. He's not going and doing the Mount Carmel things that Elijah did. He's not declaring and trying to get people to see that Jehovah is God, at least generically speaking. He's not doing the same type of thing Elisha is doing. And of course, that's not to say that Elijah didn't save people or heal people either, but the general tone of their ministry is very different. God is not concerned about the kings anymore, the royal court, and getting the nation to repent, but he is going to save his people. Jehovah has been declared God and been rejected, so he's just going to take care of the people who know that he is God. So we come to 2 Kings chapter 3, and there is a new king in Israel. And it is Jehoram. This is one of Ahab's sons in 2 Kings chapter 3. Ahab's son Jehoram is just become king. The Moabites under Ahab had given 100,000 sheep and the wool of 100,000 rams every year. You're going to pay tribute to me, and that's how it worked. Ahab did that, enforced that every year. Well, new king Jehoram, great opportunity not to have to pay. I don't want to give up that. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of goods to give over. So I'm going to rebel. I'm not going to give to this guy Jehoram, and Jehoram's not too happy about that. He says, well, we'll just see about that. So he grabs the king of Israel, or the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, and he grabs the king of Edom and says, y'all come to battle with me. Come, and we're going to get our armies together, and we're going to go show him who's boss. We're going to make him give us this tribute and show him the penalty for not subjugating himself to Israel. And so Jehoshaphat and Edom get their armies, and they come together. They're marching to Moab, and they find themselves in this dry place. They're stuck. There's no water. And so their troops are about to die. Their horses have no water. They're about to die. There's nowhere for them to go. On the way, out in the middle of a desert, essentially, might as well be, with this giant army, nothing to do. And so in verse 10 of 2 Kings chapter 3, actually let's read that in verse 9. So the king of Israel went out with the king of Judah and the king of Edom, and when they made a circuitous march of 7 days, there was no water for the army or for the animals that followed them. Then the king of Israel said, alas, the Lord, that is Jehovah, has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. And Jehoshaphat said, is there no prophet of the Lord here through whom we may inquire of the Lord? Then one of the king's servants, king of Israel's servants, answered, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah. And Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. So here they are, stuck in this situation, stranded, and you see Jehoram's reaction. God has called us out here. God has put us in this situation. Jehovah has brought us here, and he's going to kill us. Our army is going to go down the drain, as it were. And so we see him blaming God for his troubles. And I want us to keep reading then. This Israelite servant tells Jehoram where the man of God is, where Elisha is. And so he goes, the king of Israel goes to this servant and he says, tells him about the situation. And look at Elisha's response in verse 13. What have I to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and to the prophets of your mother. You see how God is dealing with the kings of Israel now? Now that they've rejected him, what are you coming to me for? I don't want anything to do with you. I don't even want you to show up on my doorstep. Don't even come asking me anything. And so he says, why don't you go back to the prophets of your parents? The same people who failed to recognize that Jehovah is God, that wanted to serve and worship the Baals. Now, Jehoram is not worshiping the Baals like his father and mother, but he's still not subjecting himself to Jehovah. He says, why don't you go back and do whatever you want to do with the religion that you've installed, but what do you have to do with me? He's just like his parents in that regard. And so Jehoram tells Elisha of the situation, and then look at his response again in verse 14. Elisha, well, let's read his reply in verse 13, the king of Israel said to him, no, it is the Lord who has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. And Elisha said, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you. He says, if it weren't for Jehoshaphat, I wouldn't even talk to you. I wouldn't give you the time of day. You're lucky he's even there, because if not, you'd be stranded in that place with no water. And you'd be dead, you'd be done. But since Jehoshaphat's with you, I'll listen. I'll do something. I think this conversation between Elisha and Jehoram ought to be a sobering moment for anyone that professes to follow God. And that is certainly a sobering moment for you and I. The people who profess to know God who want to go to him, claim to go to him, ought to have a true relationship with him. You see, he's blaming God in verse 10. He's stuck. He thinks he's going to die. And instead of entreating God, as he's always done throughout his life, as a faithful servant of God, he's going to God as someone who has never served God. And he's blaming God. He's pointing the finger at God. God, you've got me in this situation. Jehovah has done this. And I wonder how many times that may happen in our lives, that same type of reaction. That maybe we don't really serve God with our lives, but when it comes to that crucial moment, that critical moment where we need God's help the most, then we're going to blame God. It's your fault, God. You put me in this situation. It's not my own consequences. It's not that I made foolish decisions or sinned when I knew that I shouldn't have sinned or didn't listen to the word of God. No, this is God's fault. That's the attitude that Jehoram had. And it might be easy for us to do that as well. Or maybe, not even in our own case, maybe there are people that we work with or go to school with who do a similar thing, who get down in these difficult situations and they point the finger at God. I think if that's the case, something we can learn from this story is that we need to be just like that servant. You notice it's not Jehoram who knows where Elisha is. There's no indication that Jehoram even knows about Elisha in this text before going to him. Jehoshaphat says, "Where is there a prophet of the Lord here?" And in verse 11, and notice it says, "One of the king of Israel's servants answered." Jehoram didn't even know that there was any prophet of God around, but his servant did. And maybe that's our role as well. Maybe there are people around us who want to blame God, who want to say that God has put them in this situation, and we need to be the ones to point out where God is. We need to be the ones helping others to see who God is and where he is. There's a couple things we might learn from that. But Jehoram does go, and he does entreat and talk to this prophet Elisha. And that's another thing we need to think about as well. Not only does he blame God for his troubles, but he also goes to God when and expects him to get him out of those troubles as well. If we have a shallow knowledge of who God is, we might just want to pretend that he is some sort of genie in a bottle, that he's just there, and when I get in these situations, he's God, he can do it, and so he can get me out of it. And that's not the right attitude that we ought to have. That's not the attitude Jehoram ought to have had. That we're just turning to God when it's convenient for me. That it's just this one-way relationship. And I don't confess that Jehovah is God in my life in any other way. But when I'm in trouble, I'll go to him. And I'll ask him for help. We need to think about these things in our life. We need to understand how God deals with the type of people who really don't declare that he is God in their life. He's not listening to Jehoram here. His response is not, "I'm glad you've come to me," because he's shown that he really doesn't care about God. God's response is, "What have I to do with you? You're lucky this other king is here." And sometimes we might spend our time pursuing a career, finding pleasure in fleshly desires, and then we end up finding, indeed, yes, it is vanity to pursue those things. And we get ourselves in this spiritually destitute situation with no food and no water, and we're dying spiritually, and then we cry out to God and say, "God, you've done this." When we know full well that those things are vanity. And instead of being like the prodigal son who finds himself in that destitute situation and then turns to God and runs to God with a sincere heart, we get in that situation and we blame God for being in the pigsty. That's what Jehoram does. And we need to take a warning from that. We need to understand how God views those who come to him who really aren't declaring him as God in their life in any other way. Well, let's continue and look at the next story. We won't examine all of that story. They do go and have some success against Moab, but then they are repelled eventually. But in chapter 4, we have a story that follows about this widow. Chapter 4 and verse 1 of 2 Kings. Now the wife of one of the sons of the prophets cried to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, but the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." Now notice who this is, first of all. This is a prophet one of the sons of the prophets cries to Elisha. And this is someone who has served and feared Jehovah. This is one of the remnant. This is one of the 7,000. This is a family of people that did not bow the knee to Baal. They did confess, yes, Jehovah is God. And they lived as they ought to have, but they've had this unfortunate event now. This widow's, this woman's husband has died, and her two sons, her two children, are all that's left, and they're going to be sold into slavery. And she's going to be left without anyone to support her. Women in the ancient times can't just go out and get a job. They can't just go get training and do things the way we might be able to today. There's no welfare. She's destitute. Without her husband, it's bad enough. Without her children, she's stranded in the same way that Jehoram was stranded. She is in a place where there's no food and no water and no hope for the future. And so she finds herself in that similar situation. But look in verse 2 and look at the different reaction. Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you?" You see God's response to those who are faithful to him? The first thing he says is, "What can I do to help?" I'm here for you. God saves is Elisha's name. And he sees his people who have confessed that he is God. And he's asking what I can do to save you. Because you've been faithful when it's been difficult to be faithful. This family lived in a land where there was much idolatry, much social pressure certainly would come. Hey, worship Baal, worship these other gods. That's what everyone else in the cities does. That's what it means to be part of our nation, is to worship these gods. And so you need to worship them as well. It's a very difficult circumstance in which to raise a family and to have a family that confesses Jehovah is God. And so I think we find ourselves in that similar situation as well, living that type of society. We can understand how difficult it is, it would be for her, and how difficult maybe it will be even more so increasingly in the future, in our own lives, in our own society. But this is a different story. God calls and asks, what shall I do for you? And so the names of the two prophets, Elijah and Elisha, are manifested in these two stories, the different way that God deals with these people. The person that just comes to God and doesn't even really know where God is, where his prophet is, but wants to get out of the situation, "I don't want anything to do with you. You've proven to me already, you and your parents and everyone that's going to come after you has already proven that you don't want anything to do with me. And that's just fine. You're going to get exactly what you want out of that." Yet the family that confesses that Jehovah is God is the one that God saves. And both of these families, you imagine, know about the Mount Carmel incident. This is something that happened in recent history. Certainly Jehoram, if he wasn't there at Mount Carmel, he certainly heard about the story about when Jehovah overcame Baal, when Jehovah was proven to be the true God. And of course, this widow, this wife and her husband certainly lived in that time as well. And that would be a well-known story, that Jehovah did prove himself to be God on that day. And there was that choice that people had to make as to who they believed. And we see this difference in ministry, in Jesus' ministry as well, excuse me. We see the different way of dealing with people in Jesus' ministry. Jesus typically, not always, but typically heals those people who are seeking him, who are faithful to him, who are confessing that Jesus is God, or at least confessing that Jehovah is God at this point in their life. And you know, Jesus' name has some significance as well. Jehovah saves. And that's what Jesus came to do. He came not to bring a sword, but to save those who were his. That's part of his ministry as well. And so we see Jesus going around in his ministry and healing people because they had faith in him, because they were looking for him, seeking him. But you remember in Mark chapter 8, in verses 11 and 12, Mark chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, the Pharisees come to him, and he has a different response. They want a miracle. And Jesus has been going about giving miracles the entire gospel. And they come to him seeking a sign, and in verse 12, he sighed deeply in his spirit and says, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them and got into the boat again and went to the other side. "What have I to do with you?" Jesus essentially says to these Pharisees. There were plenty of signs for the Pharisees to see. He continued to heal. As a matter of fact, he continued to heal after this episode with the Pharisees. But he's not giving them a sign. Why? Why does he not want to give them a sign? Because they don't really confess that Jehovah is God in their lives. They're not really concerned with having a relationship with God. It is simply a convenience for them. Yet for those who are ill and sick and oppressed, Jesus comes and gives them signs. He comes and saves them through his miracles. To those who are oppressed and seeking God, Jesus says, "What can I do for you?" And we see this in the letter of Paul as well, that God does hold his hand out to those who seek him, to those who have a disposition to keep their faith. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. "Finally, brethren, pray for us, that the word of the Lord will spread rapidly and be glorified, just as it did also with you, and that we will be rescued from perverse and evil men. For not all have faith, but the Lord is faithful, and he will strengthen and protect you from the evil one. We have confidence in the Lord concerning you, that you are doing and will continue to do what we command." See what Paul is saying there? God is going to save those who are faithful to him. God is going to ask, when you are struggling with sin and temptation, when it's a difficult circumstance, and yet you try to serve him, you have confessed that he is your God, he's going to help you out in those circumstances. He will save. And Paul is confident that they're going to keep their faith in God, and as a result, they'll be protected. I don't know what the exact family history of the widow in 2 Kings chapter 4. I don't know what their family history was, but I'm sure it wasn't easy for them to continue to serve God. I'm sure there were times where they felt like quitting, just like a lot of the people around them certainly must have. They felt like just saying, "Well, forget it, God is clearly not going to come up in this generation and make himself known, make himself manifest as the king. He's going to continue to allow these evil kings to reject him, and we're just going to have to live in that society, and so we might as well just go with the flow. We might as well do it because God's not doing anything about it," even though he had given his name on Mount Carmel. I don't know how the situation was, but I'm certain that it was difficult for them to continue serving God and being faithful. In the book of Hebrews, we find that the Hebrew, the recipients of the letter of Hebrews are in that same boat. In Hebrews chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, the Hebrew writer says, "But beloved, we are convinced of better things concerning you, things that accompany salvation, though we are speaking in this way. For God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown towards his name." If you have been faithful to God, he's not going to forget you. And even if the circumstances seem dark and grim, and even if it seems like it's destitute, God does not forget his people who are faithful to him. And that's what we see in the story of 2 Kings chapter 4 with this widow. He did not forget, and she did not lose her faith. And it may be that God doesn't save you as far as your situation on this earth. It may be that you do have to continue living with difficult things, with consequences of sins, with things that have happened to you that are unjust and unfair. But the promise that God gives is that one day when he comes again, he will save his people. And he will not forget those who have declared with their lives that Jehovah is God. God is not unjust as to forget our work and the love that we show toward his name in confessing him with his life. You realize we live in the same story as well today. We have the same type of thing going on. We live in a world in which God has given us a great act in which he declares that he is God. It's a new act. It's a new Mount Carmel episode, so to speak, a new declaration of who God is. And that's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He has given the sign. When Jesus was raised from the dead, that means that God, that Jehovah is God, that Jesus is King. And so it's left to those who see that sign to make their decision. Are you going to reject God? Are you going to see that sign and embrace God and remain faithful to him and believe that he's going to come and make his name known again someday? We even see a second Elijah come in the story of the gospel. John the Baptist comes, getting ready, getting people ready to see that really Jehovah is God, the second Elijah. And so we live just as Jehoram and this widow lived, with Mount Carmel ringing in their ears, with that story being told and being remembered. We live with the resurrection still ringing in our ears as well. That story is still being told. And God doesn't do these Mount Carmel resurrection episodes for every generation. He doesn't have to prove himself over and over. He gives the sign for people in history. And so there's not going to be another Mount Carmel episode, just like there wasn't another Mount Carmel episode for the kings of Israel. They didn't get another chance to see God's power until they went into captivity. And we're not going to see another act like that until Jesus comes again. But we do have that same story going on. We live with some people who see that act and reject God. And hopefully we are the type of people who embrace God, who declare that Jehovah is God and know that Jehovah saves. And so the question this morning for you is which story is your story? Are you living the life of Jehoram, the life of convenience? Are you blaming God when things get down? Are you proving to God that you're really not concerned about what he has to say to you or about who he is? Blaming him when things go wrong, turning to him when it's convenient for you. Is that your life? If that is your life, and that means anything to you, if that pricks your heart, you still have a chance to turn to God. You know, the kings of Israel still had the opportunity. It's not that God didn't want them to turn to him. It's just that they proved that they didn't want God anymore. So if you're here and you have a heart this morning that has been pricked and you've thought about those things, God will accept you. You can declare with your life that Jehovah is God. And maybe you find yourself in the story of the widow, that things have been difficult for you, that life is not fair, that it's hard to live in the society, it's hard to live in whatever circumstances you're living in. You need to be encouraged. You need to know that Jehovah is God and that Jehovah saves and that he will save. And we want to offer you, if you need the encouragement of the prayers of the brethren this morning, or if you need to be baptized and join God's people, we want to offer you that invitation. Won't you come now while we stand?
I believe.